now.
This is getting better and better.
Get some recipes.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I can't believe you've done this.
Welcome to the Evolve Podcast, a podcast that explores personal evolution through our choices and overcoming life's challenges. The Evolve community is your ultimate destination for personal growth and evolution.
True to form, I get to continue to be the dumbest person in the room. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Did you ever get a quantum physical explanation for how to bake a meatloaf from a porn star?
Well, Sky, so let's get rolling here on the pre-show. What is it? What's inspiring you right now? Are you listening to some music? Are you reading a book? Is there a person in your life? What's inspiring Skylar Main right now?
Get you going.
Yeah, I think as weird as this is, going into like the NFL Combine and Pro Day type season right now, there's been a lot of discussion in the fitness, you know, and professional fitness space as like what data and metrics actually mean through all of these different athletes. So there's a couple of people that have been pushing the conversation as far as, you know, what actually matters to athletes, and it's gone into a lot of like the mental aspect of athletics, of fitness, and the guys that are kind of moving the field forward. I'm actually pretty good friends with, but they're all younger, you know, they're all under 40 years old, and it's been interesting to me. One guy in particular, his name is Les Spellman, and he does a lot of like the speed training for the combine, but what he's developed is basically himself, myself, some other practitioners in the world are kind of doing the whole money ball theme that they did with baseball of, how can you create wins? How can you help a player move forward? And so it's kind of the cusp of all of that right now. And for me, the inspiring part of it is there's, you know, things I'm doing in that world and others that it's the first time it's ever been done. So there's not a book or a podcast that necessarily has been inspiring me, but kind of pushing, you know, elite athletic data, if you want to call that, forward. It's kind of a cool space to be right now because it's never been done in certain facets.
Well, I've read a lot of stuff recently where they're talking about maybe you and I even had this conversation one day too at the gym, but I've read that there's a lot of question out there as to whether the combine itself, the physical challenges that they put people into, does that go into any type of performance at all on the field? Because you'll have these guys that will do really well on the combine. They get on the team and they are, you know, it's not a determinant of success. So I can see why that would be an interesting thing to you to be involved in.
Yeah, it's like the metrics behind all the combine stuff are kind of, they're cool. And it's kind of, we call it a pony show, you know, the guys go out and dance around and look good, but
yeah.
The 40 yard dash was developed because that's the average distance you run on a kickoff. So like, you know, even nowadays, it doesn't matter like how many kickoffs actually happen in a game that the ball's returned.
Yeah.
Right.
And so there's looking at acceleration data. So how quickly someone accelerates, their miles per hour. I think you'll see the whole combine change in probably the next 5 to 10 years. Just
that's really interesting, Skylar. I was reading up on you and tell you how old I am. I was in my college football years when you were born. So, but what you just said reminded me when thinking back on the 40 yard dash, like I remember in high school, there was a lot of emphasis on the 40. Yeah. Like what's your time? You're an old lineman. You got to be here and you got to be in this range and blah, blah, blah. I got to college and they didn't really care too much what my 40 was. What they cared a lot was this agility box. It was a 10-yard box and how quickly I could get through this whatever and this different movements of lateral explosion and angles and all that mattered a lot more than how fast I ran 40 yards.
I don't think they really cared about that. They just wanted to watch you run around in a box, Casey. That was the main thing there. And with that, folks, we want to.
That's a bad white boy right there. That's a bad one.
And with that, folks, we want to welcome you to another episode of the Evolve Podcast, a podcast that explores personal evolution through our choices and overcoming the challenges life throws at us. And just before, just getting off of his shift, handing out leaflets on the Las Vegas Strip, is my co-host Casey Mitch Mitchell.
Yeah,
Casey, welcome.
Thank you.
And the zero-star Michelin-rated chef living amongst the Amish country in Ohio. Living
amongst the Amish.
That's right.
Is W. Miles Riley. Welcome, Miles.
Jeremiah needs some more beans.
They make some pies out here that could be legally deemed a drug.
You ain't kidding on that.
It's 4:30, time for milking.
That's right.
Crawling to the mic after a brutal trail run in the mountains of Utah, I'm Steve Cutler. Today, our guest is Dr. Skylar Main. Skylar, welcome to the Evolve Podcast. We're excited to have you.
Having me.
Yeah. So Dr. Skylar Main is a former Division I athlete and a U.S. skeleton team member. He founded and runs Main Performance, a multidisciplinary performance center focusing on sports medicine, recovery, and elite performance. During the offseason, he trains and works with professional athletes. And I want to emphasize, excuse me, trains, because Skylar actually works out with some of these professional athletes to show them that the coach knows what he's talking about. But he works with people of all major disciplines, with a focus on NFL offseason and combine prep. During his professional athletic seasons, he travels and treats his athletes across the country, bringing them some of the most advanced techniques to help them accelerate healing and increased performance. From working with some of the top tier athletes around the world to the average everyday athletes, his philosophy is to treat all at the same level as the elite athlete, since everyone is an athlete in their own right. So Skylar, once again, welcome. We are excited to have you. And, you know, your intro and bio leads me to my first question. You really do work with and train people from all walks of life, all levels of fitness. I'd love to hear, what are some of the similarities and what are some of the differences between working with, let's say, guys like us on the podcast, who are your average everyday people, and someone who's a professional.
I hand out leaflets on the strip, man. Come on.
Skylar, neither one of these two guys are going to stand up level, so you can see them, although Miles was slightly nude earlier. But let me assure you, they are average. So the average guys like us to the professional athletes, what are some of the similarities and what are the differences that you see?
A number of good counselor I could call.
I'll send it to you.
All right.
And you go, whether it's similarities or differences, what do you see?
Yeah, I think I would say the biggest similarity is across the board, everybody wants to be, they want that elite level of care, you know, whether they're picking up their grandkid and throw out their back, or they're, you know, trying to sack Ben Roethlisberger in the NFL. Like, they, at the end of the day, want that care and attention. And when I say that everybody's an athlete, it's true in the fact that a lot of the injuries overlap, but the mechanism of how they happen is different, you know? So
that's interesting.
We kind of, in the medical world, you have these sports medicine doctors, and then you go to your average everyday doctor. Well, I think you really separate yourself in giving the quality of care to your elite level athletes as well as to everybody else. But the outcomes are that much better. There's buy-in from the patient. And then if you're trying to get someone back as quick as possible, for an athlete, that's millions of dollars if they're missing games and seasons. But for your average person, you know, if they're missing work or missing their kids' games, it's just as important. So I try not to, like I said, treat them any different, because at the end of the day, it's that person in front of you should be just as important as the next.
Okay, so the similarity is that everybody needs that attention and the care. But you talked about that everybody gets injured, you know, regardless of what we're doing. What's the difference, or what are some of the differences that you see in working with general population versus some of your elite athletes?
I think, you know, sometimes there's the severity of the injury. With a professional bull rider, obviously the injury is a little more severe than someone who slips and falls on the ice, though, you know, sometimes there's overlap. I would probably say the biggest difference is the buy-in to what we do. Most of the time with the athletes I work with, if I tell them to do something, it gets done. And the result is then, you know, that much greater versus your average everyday person. A lot of the time they come in and just want the quick fix. And if I have them do something on their own, if it's not done, the outcome is not as great. And so it's the follow through at the end of the day.
Yeah, what a great point. A pro is a pro because they're going to be following through.
Yeah,
but I wonder
their job at that point. You know?
Yeah, it really is. And to me, that idea is interesting, fascinating, and sad all at the same time, because everyone lives in their body. And what if everybody realized and came to that awareness that your body is what makes you the best or the worst at whatever you do? If you're an accountant, if you are a server at a restaurant, your body is going to make you the best or the worst at what you do. And if you take care of your body like a professional would, and you follow through on some of that, I mean, you'd get phenomenal results. So compliance to what you're giving them might be a difference. Any other similarities or differences that you see between general population and the athletic population?
I think something's probably interesting for, you know, listeners and people to hear is a lot of these athletes, as soon as their career is over, they hit kind of a wall where they don't know what they're doing. And then the injuries start to stack up because they stop training, they stop treating, they stop doing all these things that they did as an athlete. And all of a sudden they go to do an athletic movement and an injury happens.
Yeah.
And that can happen for your average person too, who played, you know, basketball in high school. The way they trained and the way they ate and slept was probably different than what it is now. And they get frustrated when they go try to do something athletic and get hurt. And I look at them like, well, you know, are you still training like an athlete? You don't have to be going as hard, but are you still doing those little things daily?
Yeah.
To function at some athletic level.
So let's talk about some of those little things. You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting, when you and I reconnected a few months ago, I hadn't seen you since you were in high school, I think. Is that right?
High school or maybe middle school.
Middle school or high school. Yeah. And so I walk in, this was a really, to me, it was a funny story because I haven't seen you in years. And I go walking into the gym and you're working on my friend TJ, who is the owner and general manager of the gym. And TJ says, hey, you remember Skyler? You used to train him back in the day. And I look at you and here's this taller grown up version of this little kid that I used to work with. And I said, well, yeah, we haven't seen each other. What have you been up to? And you kind of run through your resume. And I jokingly said, well, I'm glad you've set your bar very low for yourself, Skyler. I mean, you're only a doctor now. But you, one of the things that I've seen in coming to you, because I've had some injuries and I've had to come to you to get some things fixed, your standard response after a treatment session is, here's some exercises, here's some stretches, whatever it is, here's what you need to do. Do these things and you probably don't need to see me again. Or if you do, you don't need to see me again for a while. Now, a lot of people that work in the recovery side, whether it's a sports medicine doctor, whether it's a chiropractor, whether it's someone who does post rehabilitative work, they set up a system where they're constantly getting you back. In fact, that's one of the things, bluntly, that chiropractors have a really bad name around, is that it's, let me get you on this 20-week program where we're going to adjust you and you're going to be stuck with me for a really long time. You go the opposite direction. You do some different modalities and you say, all right, you're good to go. I've actually sent some people to you, and it's rare if you see somebody more than two or three times to fix a problem. So what is it that you're doing different?
Yeah. So, you know, the approach when everybody walks through the door is initially we want to get them out of pain. So okay. as quick as we can do that, pain is a factor that it forces us to move differently. It causes other issues, other places in the body. So we get them out of pain and then we start to reinforce those proper movement or proper mechanics. We know overall that movement is helpful to the body. The body likes movement. And so your body will accomplish a task regardless of if it's detrimental to you or not. And that's a lot of the time why we get pain. So we eliminate pain, get correct movement. And we try to get, you know, buy-in from the patient to believe in what we're doing, but also have them be part of their own healing process. It's been proven through, you know, study after study, not just in my world, but if people buy into their surgeon, they believe their surgeon, their outcome's greater. If people do their own homework, I call it homework, but you know, their own exercises at home, their outcome is better. It's more than 80 or 90% better outcome than someone who doesn't. And the results are longer lasting. So those are just facts across the medical world in general. So if I know those and I apply those to people, you can fall into a trap of someone just relying on you as the practitioner to fix all of their issues, when really they're in control of a lot of that. So I try to let people, you know that they're safe to do things. I give them that comfort. And then from there, we kind of let them back into the world to do their activities. And, you know, I give them the option of they can text me, they can call me, they have ways of getting in contact if something happens. And the outcomes are greater for me because there's the buy-in on their end. I don't really waste my time doing things that won't get results, might get results. I stick to the things that I know will work and work long time. Work long term. And so with that, that's where the exercises come in after our treatment. That's where if people do need a plan, we can set it up. I have patients I've had, you know, hip replacements, knee replacements, and those aren't just one and done type things. But you know, and blending these different facets of rehab and chiropractic and being a strength and conditioning coach, we transition them out and off the table as quick as we can and into actual movement, into their activities that they want to do. And overall, people just respond better because they don't feel fragile. They don't feel like they're in a box and can't do things, but they're doing things in a safe way. And that actually just promotes healing overall for them. So it kind of is a no-brainer for me to get someone better quicker.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, you said the first thing, get out of pain, right?
Yeah.
So you get somebody out of pain, you're promoting the healing, you're promoting movement, and then movement is the right movement is going to reinforce healing. I think back to when I was in high school, my wife in her junior year blew out her ACL. Senior year, she was fortunate enough to blow out her other ACL, and both years they had immobilized those knees. And for, I don't remember what it was, 3 or 6 months, but it was a ridiculous amount of time. And it turns out that she and I went to rehab at the same time because I had one of those years because I had ruined one of my ankles. And so they're going through and they're breaking up scar tissue and getting her knee moving. And here I am trying to rehab my ankle at the same time. And so I saw how painful that was. Well, fast forward, we're married. And in our first year of marriage, one of our good friends blew out his ACL. Before he woke up from the surgery, they had him in a machine that was moving his leg and moving the knee. And that was unbelievable to me at the time. I had no idea that that was that they had shifted so dramatically in those, I'd say 5 to 6 years, but movement is healing for people if it's the right way. So let's talk about a little bit about program design. When you're designing a program for somebody that's coming out of some sort of injury, so first thing, you get them out of pain, but that you get them moving. How do you design a program that's going to keep people moving and keep them healthy? What are some of the factors that you consider?
I think first and foremost, I look at each individual as to what activity is most important to them. You know,
Okay.
The easiest one to get into is runners. Like, I mean, across the board, there's some of the craziest athletes out there. So they're going to run no matter what, you know, no matter the weather, the injury, whatever. So how can we get them interested in whatever activity it is? And then, you know, from there, we kind of reverse engineer it. Like, well, they want to run a marathon after they've, you know, had whatever injury. So what are the steps and timeline that it takes to get there? And what are the requisites that the body needs to have in order to do that?
Okay.
So a very easy way to start is we look at range of motion of certain areas of the body. Do they have adequate range of motion there? Or is that what caused the injury previously?
So let's take runners. What's a common injury that you see with a runner? So when you're saying, okay, this person wants to run, maybe they want to go do a 10K, maybe they want to run a marathon, or maybe they're an ultra. What are some things that you're assessing when you're looking at their, before you go into their program design?
So I'll look at, you know, hip internal and external rotation as we go through the gait cycle or the pattern of running. The hip has to have a certain amount of degrees of internal and external rotation, or your foot would hit the ground as you run. If it's not rotating properly in your hip socket, then there's a compensation somewhere. Either the low back pulls up and tries to help the leg clear, so you get low back pain. The knee will kick out, so you can get knee pain. The ankle will dorsiflex super hard, so you can get ankle pain. So there's all these different things you can look at. Sometimes it's their opposite shoulder now that hurts because they lean away from it and use their upper torso to rotate. So there's all of these injuries can be caused by the same mechanism of running, and it can all be related to the hip. So that's a real easy example of, and we're talking about, you know, millimeters of difference or even less than that. But if we fix some of those things, the body responds, the pain goes away, they can continue their activity and they never needed to stop. We just add to, you know, their warm-up routine or their cool down routine. And we see the biggest change in exercises, because about the first 2 weeks of exercise, 2 to 4 weeks, all the changes that happen are neurological. No one's getting stronger. The muscle's not being built, but the brain is adapting to that movement. And if we put the right exercise into place, the brain creates the right pathway and we see changes really quickly. It's not like they got stronger anywhere. Muscle takes longer to build than that. But
so say that again. I think that's an important point that people don't understand. And I think it's crucial, because when you talk about a recovery program or you talk about any type of program, I'm trying to get stronger, I'm trying to lose weight. Say that again about the neurological adaptation.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically it becomes an efficiency of movement. So the brain has to create a way of a new movement. So if you're put into a new exercise, the brain is learning out how to accomplish that exercise. So in my world, we're fixing a movement that was done improperly for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Or even after they felt pain, they moved differently around that pain. So,
and so the first period of time, your number one goal is to get a coordinated movement, to get neural adaptation. You're not necessarily making this person stronger because their muscle is getting bigger. They're not necessarily going to lose any weight with this. You're just creating a coordinated movement pattern, right?
Correct.
And that's normal. So
that's normal. That's
and the reason I want to point that out is I think a lot of people, they get 2-3 weeks into a program, or they get 2-3 weeks into some sort of recovery, and they just give up because they're looking at the wrong, as you talked about at the very beginning, when you're talking about what's inspiring you, that there are metrics that you look at. And these metrics, the metric, if I'm assuming massive biceps and I'm assuming my legs are going to get bigger and I'm assuming I'm going to lose all this weight, but really the first 2 weeks are just kind of creating a foundational coordination. I'm looking at the wrong metrics, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're going to see for a bicep curl, for example, right? The first 2, 3, 4 weeks, like you might jump, you know, 10, 15, 20% in the weight that you're doing, but you didn't gain any muscle size. You didn't even, you know, necessarily increase strength. You increased efficiency.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the metric after that is what takes longer. And that's where people get frustrated from a weight loss standpoint, from, you know, a strength standpoint or whatever it is. There becomes a plateau, if you want to call it that, or a slowing of progress. And it's the same thing in the sports med world and the healing world. I can get someone out of pain pretty quickly, but then the body has all these other barriers you have to break through. You know, post ACL surgery, I can get that knee to move really well in 2 weeks. But the strength is gone. The movement pattern's gone. All of it has to be relearned in a sense. The brain has to relearn how to do it and do it the right way.
Are you really adjusting your head? Or are you like flexing for us every once in a while? Because I noticed you kind of dropped and you did both sides. You came up here and then you here. I was like, okay. He's showing us that it works.
He's showing us the going. Guns. Yeah.
The guns, baby. Welcome to the gun show.
So, you know, when you are, Skylar, when you're putting somebody through a program, you mentioned before that you want to know what are their activities, what do they like to do, and then what are the limitations for those activities? So after you're identifying some of those limitations that will prevent them from going to their goal, and you're starting to say, okay, how do we, so like an internal and external rotation on the hip, you've got to address that first. What are some other factors that you take into account when you're putting together somebody's program design?
Yeah, I think knowing who's in front of you as far as, you know, what their buy-in is, what's their motivation, what's pushing them forward into all of that, because at some point, you know, whether it's just someone who's trying to get stronger or it's a professional athlete, they're going to hit roadblocks and barriers, and you have to be able to address that within their programming. Mm. I have, you know, a fair number of NFL guys, and I don't care at all if they have big biceps, but to some of them, that's really important. So at some point during the workout, we add things in like that, and for them, they love it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything for me. I don't care about it. You know, some of these guys want photographers and videographers there, so we have that. For your average, you know, everyday person, they want to be able to do whatever activities they want, like we said. But they also want to know that there's an end to their pain, or there's an end to what's going on, that they're not perpetually stuck in this, you know, kind of broken state.
And I love how when you talked about that, the individual has to be able to own their body, and they've got to own the recovery. You're going to provide tools and resources, and you're going to, I think that's an empowering thing to teach somebody, that they are owning their recovery. You're going to teach them, you're going to guide them along the way, but ultimately they own the recovery. So the human being that's sitting in front of you, if I'm hearing you right, is one of the most important factors that you take into a program design.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big research buff, but I read it to stay up on it. But some of the glaring things that I learned both in school and out in, you know, early on in practice was just how much buy-in people had to what your practitioner was saying and the outcomes. You know, it was... Mm-hmm. They were having the same surgeon do the same 50 surgeries, and those who believed in the surgeon and those who didn't, they had people come in and say he was either good or bad. Their outcomes were so massively different that you can't ignore the mental factor of treating and healing somebody. There's times that I've worked with people and I've, you know, worked in areas that I thought were going to help. And then like when they leave, I'm like, well, you know, I didn't really do anything. Like nothing actually happened. Like physiologically, there was nothing that was changed in that moment. And I'll see them the next day and they are completely, you know, they're good to go. They're back to doing whatever they need. And call it placebo, call it whatever you want, but that is an effective treatment that's been proven to work. And so I don't discredit it. I just use it as another modality, as another tool. I mean, I've had people come in, we've sat and talked, I've done nothing other than talk and tell them they're good to go, nothing's gonna happen, they're fine. And then 2 days, you know, they're fine, they're great. And that's on them buying in and believing what I said. And it's not me making things up, it's I'll give them the straight truth. But if they have that buy-in, the outcomes follow as well.
Yeah. Well, it does make a big difference, I think, having that sense of confidence from a person who knows what they're talking about. I mean, I felt that way when I don't even exactly know what I did to my shoulder, but all of a sudden I've got this bone sticking up out of it. And you worked on me 2 or 3 times and you said, you're good. Like it's not going to inhibit your function. You should be fine. Go lift. and I've been fine. And there's been no issues. There's been no problems. But when I looked in the mirror and I see this bone sticking out of my up from my shoulder, there's an initial shock there, and I'm questioning myself whether it's fine. So the mind is a very powerful thing, but I think getting perspective from a, what I would say is an ethical practitioner, is a really important thing.
I think, I mean, one funny example I give people all the time is I have a guy who, you know, plays professional hockey for the Boston Bruins.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't played a game in about 2 years. He had some stuff going on with the knee and whatever. And I got a phone call from him that he's like, "You're the guy I've heard to come see, blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "Great. Like, I don't know how you got my number, but we're talking."
It was on the wall of the bathroom. Yeah.
That's fine with me if that's how
his name is. Seabass.
Yeah, there you go.
we start getting into some of the stuff, and you know, I'm on my third treatment with him, and stuff's just not progressing as fast as I want it to, but I know there's nothing wrong with his knee anymore. I've done my due diligence. I know it's good to go. I want to return him back to full activity, you know,
mm-hmm.
And he's not feeling it. So I have him go in the weight room. I have him, you know, he was doing a lunge, and we have him a strap putting some different pressure on him, making him rotate and whatever. While he's doing it, I walked up next to him with a foam roller and just, this probably sounds terrible, I just whacked his knee. I just hit hard in the knee. And he looked at me like kind of a shock, and I was like, "Is your knee okay?" And he's like, "Yeah." And from that moment, he hadn't played in 2 years, and he hasn't missed a game due to anything this year. So he's, you know, it was his mental block that was there. And the only way that I had told him it was okay, I had done things to show him it was okay. But as a professional hockey player, he knows he's going to get hit. And I guess he just needed to get hit.
I love
it. So this is like you're training 10 years
by
old.
2x4.
Yes.
So, you know, he's 10 years old. He's sitting in the living room with his family. The TV goes wonky. His dad gets up and whacks it, and he remembers it.
I mean, I've put knee replacement patients who are 70 years old under 400 pounds on a squat rack, just have them unrack it and put it right back in the rack. And they feel like, you know what? Hey, it didn't crush me, you know? And it's a very... I make sure it's safe before we do. I'm not just doing crazy.
Obviously, yeah, right.
But that being said, when there's a mental aspect, there's a little bit of you kind of have to jar them a little bit.
You really do. Barriers. You have to disrupt whatever that mental pattern is in order to get them into something different. It's funny you say that, because back in the day when you were young and I was training another athlete about the same time, and she was a collegiate softball player. And she came to see me second off season. I trained her the season before, second off season. She said, "God, my performance in the, you know, latter part of the season was waning, and I don't know what's wrong. And my coach says my pitching is off, and I'm worried about losing my position." And I said, "Well, let's take a look at it." And sure enough, she had developed some imbalances in her body because of that rotational pattern, that overuse pattern. And so we tweaked a couple of things. We got her a little bit balanced. And I said, "Okay, now let's go. I want to watch you pitch." And even though we had fixed everything from a musculoskeletal standpoint, she goes into the pitch and she was pitching the way that she was before we fixed everything. And I said, no, you got to try something different. And I had her, like you, I didn't hit her, but I had her do something funny or weird right before. And I said, "Now close your eyes and visualize yourself at the beginning of last season, pitch like that." And she started to go in the opposite direction. And I jumped in front of her and yelled, and she stopped. And she's like, "Oh my gosh, what the hell are you doing?" And I said, "I'm breaking the pattern. I need you to do it again. Visualize yourself at the beginning of last season." The next pitch was perfect. And I looked at her and I said, "You've got it. That was perfect. Do that every time." She did, rep after rep after rep. She came back to see me after that season, said, "Steve, I broke every record that the school has in my senior year. And All it was the mental change. So it is amazing what that disruption of the mind can do. Now, Skyler, you spend a lot of time working with clients, working with patients on injury prevention, but or injury recovery. But I know you focus a lot on injury prevention, and I see that in your training too. There's a lot of products out there. There's a lot of pills and powders and buy this
and gels.
Yeah, everything out there when it comes to recovery or prevention. I know what my opinion on most of those are. I'm pretty sure I know what your opinion is as well. What works for prevention of injury? Let's talk about that. What are some things that you found are effective in prevention of injury?
I think we'll get the most boring,
gummies.
Most effective.
Gummies, thank you. Yes.
Gummies. Brownies.
Yeah.
Brownies.
Oh my gosh.
Kind of tie into what I'd say first. And the first one overall is there's sleep. Sleep in general. So you want to talk about brownies and gummies.
Skyler, when you say sleep, go a little bit further into that. What do you mean?
Well, he was saying brownies and gummies. Let him go.
Oh, come on. He's speaking Miles'
language. Yeah.
I mean, sleep is just an underrated, it's the most effective recovery tool. So getting adequate sleep, getting deep sleep, having a regular sleep schedule. They've proven that if you have a set time that you go to bed every night, the amount of rest or recovery that your body has upon waking up is just greater. So whether you're sleeping less or the hours change that you sleep, if you go to bed at the same time every night, your body gets used to a certain pattern or a certain cycle of sleep that affects hormone levels. It affects, you know, just about everything in your life. So all the pills, goos and gels and tape and all of that, like, they can have a place as a supplement, but if you're not sleeping well, if you don't have proper nutrition, getting the proper nutrients, it doesn't really matter what you do else on top of it. You can't replace those things.
This is where I vigorously start taking notes. Sleep.
Yeah, I know. It's super boring. It's super lame.
No, I mean, I don't amazing. Think it's lame or boring. Like you said, creating the pattern to do that.
The problem in any athletic training, any profession, or anything we do is, you know, we want it, what's the coolest, sexiest thing to do to get me there the quickest? And you said, Sky, well, these things are boring and repetitive or whatever, but the reality is if it's not broke, don't fix it mentality. And if a consistent sleep pattern is a key component of prevention, then that's what you do, right? I mean,
yeah. And I think if, like, you know, to really get into the sleep science of it, you can start then diving into, you know, the temperature of the room, the light that you have in your room.
Yeah.
And that stuff to me has more merit than just, you know, what drink can I have real quick that actually is going to mimic my recovery, right? If you're actually recovering and sleeping and then you add any of those other supplements to it, sure, they might play part of that. But I get asked all the time, you know, what supplement should I be taking, whether it's for sleep or performance? I'm like, well, what's your diet like? If you're not eating well to begin with, it doesn't matter what supplement you take at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, sleep. So the way I look at it is sleep has always been, you think about recovery as like a pyramid. There are some things at the top of the pyramid. If you can make it to the top of the pyramid, there might be a few things from a supplement or an additional modality that you can put in to recover. But sleep is the foundation, and it is a massive foundation because you're getting both psychic recovery and you're getting physical recovery during great sleep. You know, I've always, if anybody wants supplements and they feel like that's going to be some sort of magic bullet, I think they're off. They're turning the pyramid upside down. But B, if you're going to take any supplement, from my perspective, tell me your thoughts on this. the first supplements you should be taking are supplements to help you to get to sleep so that you can sleep and sleep longer, because that's where your recovery is going to happen. So how do you, let's say someone comes to you, Skylar, and they've got a very poor sleep pattern. You know that they're constantly inflamed, they're injured, they're not getting better. You're doing all of the quote unquote right things in the GM or on the recovery table. How do you get them to sleep? That's a problem for a lot of Americans. What's your modality? What's the methodology that you use?
Yeah, so I start by, you know, game planning what they're eating, eating and drinking before they go to bed. So alcohol is one of the number one disruptors of good sleep. You can sleep 10 hours after a night of drinking, but the quality of what you're getting is so low that it's, you almost would be better to wait till it was out of your system and then sleep.
Which is funny, because a lot of people will, they may do something to get to sleep. They may have that nightcap, or they may get a glass of, I hear a lot of the times people say, well, I got to have my glass of red wine so that I can get to sleep. So what you're saying is it's going to disrupt their sleep, and it's going to make it a lot worse if they're doing that.
Yeah. I mean, we think about sleep as just when you're, you know, unconscious to the world, right? But there's different levels, there's different cycles of your sleep. Hormonally, you have different peaks for males, right? When testosterone and growth.
You just said unconscious to the world, and I think that describes about 90% of Casey's life. So no response, Mitch?
I am dialed in.
All right. Sorry.
Keep going. Dialed in.
So different levels of sleep.
Yeah, there's different levels of sleep. So we start, you know, with a really simple pattern for someone. What is a cycle that they can stick to as far as maybe when they're eating and drinking last? Maybe they always have to wake up and go to the restroom. That could be a factor. Are they stressed and worried about work or their family? Well, what can we do to then mitigate that? Do they need to journal before they go to bed? Do they need to watch an episode of The Office for 20 minutes? I mean, when I was in med school, I had to completely shut off my brain from studying, or I wouldn't sleep. So I watched an episode of The Office every single night. It was 20 minutes. I could focus on that and nothing else. And then I went to bed. I didn't keep studying all night. I never once studied through the night when I was going through school, and I went to the gym every day, and all of those things benefited my sleep, because I would be physically tired. I had mentally done my work, but then I had my schedule of at 10 o'clock. I watched my show no matter where I was at with my studies, and was asleep. I
love how you bring that up, though. Watching something that's funny.
Something that, you know, there's no impact to life.
Yeah, right. Right.
Perfect.
Now there are some ultra sleep experts that would say don't look at a screen, you know, wear these glasses, darken your room, and I get that. I understand that's probably like the pinnacle of the pyramid when it comes to fixing your sleep. But I love how you're talking about get something that you enjoy right before bed. What, why do you think that's so important?
You know, I think it was the weirdest thing. I don't know why I remember this, but I had a psychologist. I had a meeting with a psychologist when I was in med school. They met with everybody. And that was the one thing he said, was just have the ability to shut your brain off. And I was like, okay, why would I do that? You know? Because when you're in a, you know, a graduate or a doctorate program, or I would argue if you, you know, are your average everyday American who has all these worries and issues, if you're constantly stressed about that, even if you get to sleep, the quality of it's not great. And that's where people turn to these other crutches, you know, of a drink or of a sleep pill. But what's the quality of sleep? Mm-hmm. And most of the time, I've found that it's anxiety over something, you know. So if you can shut that anxiety off enough to get your body to recognize, like, hey, I am tired, then when you turn off the TV, like, you're able to just stay in that state of, you know, whether it's bliss, euphoria, or even kind of forgetfulness, but you can go to sleep and you're that much more prepared to take on the issue of the following day, as opposed to trying to take it on at 50% because you're just getting crappy sleep.
Yeah, it's amazing. What's a quote from Mark Twain? He said, I've known a great many troubles in life, and some of them actually happened. But the majority of our troubles never happen. And so having some sort of distraction before bed is a great way to go into that slumber.
You can always get, you know, Samuel Jackson has just a book called Go to Fuck to Sleep.
I forgot about that. I've heard him read that. That is actually pretty funny.
I think that would be the entryway. You know, first,
there you go.
Yeah. First you start to create the pattern. No, first you get the book, then you start creating the ritual, and then move on to certain levels before you start taking any supplement. But
yeah,
I just think the whole idea of a bed ritual oftentimes really works. You know, same time every night, same time every night, same time. Yeah.
Tuck yourself in, same way.
Tuck yourself in.
So sleep, I think we've covered that one really well, that's a great prevention. It's great for recovery as well. What else do you teach people for prevention of injury so that people can do whatever activities, whatever sports they want to do? What's the next thing?
So again, it's, variety of life. So variety in your workouts, variety in activities. Body's inherently lazy. So if you do something over and over and over again, it's going to find the easiest route to accomplish that task.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't have to just change your exercise routine just to change routine, but you should be doing, you know, varying the weight, varying the tempo. You should change exercises from time to time. There's so many ways in a workout sense that you can change life, but then in your day-to-day life, you know, I mean, people come to me with low back pain and their low back hurts when they sit. And then other people come to me and their low back hurts when they stand. And my answer is usually just do the opposite more. And it, you know, like, oh, I never thought about that. Like, well, yeah, your body accommodates to whatever you do in life, just as a general statement, no matter what the activity.
When my brother-in-law was younger, he was, I can't remember what the age was that they tell the story, but, you know, he was at the doctor's office for a checkup, and and the doctor said, now, Ryan, is there anything else? Does anything hurt on your body? And he puts his arm up in the air and he waves it like this really fast and really hard. And he says, yeah, when I do this, it hurts my arm. And the doctor just smiled and laughed and looked at him and said, don't do that.
Don't do that.
And here's this little kid. He says, oh, okay. But I bring that up because a lot of what you're talking about is just common sense of, well, if you're sitting a lot, you probably should stand more. That's why your back is hurting. If you're standing a lot, you should probably sit more. And that's why your back is hurting. Give us one more common sense tool or resource that people can utilize to prevent injury.
Yeah, you know, I think we talked about it earlier, but training like an athlete, and when I say that, you know, there's a mentality and an intensity and an intention behind that.
So when you say train like an athlete, Casey just left to go put his singlet on because he wants to be a wrestler. That's his Greco-Roman dream. Okay, so train like a
Greco-Roman dream.
So like I was talking to my dad. So my dad always tries to, you know, pick my brain and on similar things because he's, you know, older, but he still rides his bike and skis and whatever. And I was at the gym with him, and I had him do, you know, I don't even know what movement, but I can't tell you how many people. It was something like a bottoms up kettlebell press or something. And I had just, 20 people come up to me like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this? And I was like, well, you know, in the real world, outside of a weight room, what weight do you pick up or what movement do you do that is symmetrical and safe and balanced? It doesn't exist.
Right.
And yet we train that way and expect the result to be different for us because we're just training instead of not training.
Right.
Yeah. I loved a recent video you put out on your Instagram showing one of your professional football players and here he is doing a squat or a lunge. I'm not sure what it was.
No one, I don't think anybody else has mentioned this, but
Oh, I loved it. I'm watching it, and you've got a weight on one side and nothing on the other side of that. Yeah. Yeah. I got you. I understand where you're going on this.
Yeah.
But it's true. That is day-to-day life. You're never picking up something that is perfectly symmetrical. So train in a way that's going to mimic life. Now let's talk real quick about once somebody does get injured, because it happens to all of us. There's mental barriers, but there's physical barriers. Skylar, what do you mentioned before, you got to get them out of pain first, and then you got to get them moving. Once you get them out of pain and you get them to the movement standpoint, what's your goal there? What are you trying to get them to move to do? I know you mentioned before, if they're a runner, you want them to run, but standard everyday general population, what are you getting them to do?
Yeah. So I want to get them back to, I'm thinking of the best way to word this. It's, you know, normal movement. So normal for them. A lot of the injuries that I deal with are usually actually the compensation of a previous injury. So that's where we get into this like voodoo-y type thing where someone's right shoulder hurts and I work on their left ankle they broke 2 years ago and their right shoulder stops hurting. I'm like, wow.
I see you looking at me because you did the same to me. Yeah.
It sounds similar to you.
Right. Yeah.
But they develop, again, back to the body being lazy, it develops a way to accomplish a task, even if it's not the right movement or right firing pattern. So it's getting back to that, you know, baseline where they're moving naturally. And with that natural movement, then whatever activity they want to do at that point, I'm not worried about, because they're starting from a good place instead of starting from a compromised position or compromised place.
Okay. So get them back to doing some of the things that they like to do. You do use different modalities to get them out of pain, but you know, when you explain it, it actually really makes a lot of sense because of the connectivity of the body and how it all works together. I want to shift gears, Skylar, because we're getting a little bit close to our time today, but I want to talk just a little bit about you. And you're a pretty humble guy. You're a very soft-spoken guy. You are a guy who has a wealth of knowledge. If somebody saw you walking around, they wouldn't always know what is in that mind of yours. And it's a wealth of knowledge. And you are somebody that I would classify as a true evolutionary, because you have evolved personally, but also you are in a lot of different ways helping to evolve this profession of recovery and training. And as you and I have talked, you've shared with me some really cool things of how to train and eat and live my life in a different way. What do you do to tap into your creative powers so that you're constantly evolving personally? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm constantly on the lookout for other ways of helping individuals. And in my specific world, because I'm dealing with a lot of, you know, professional athletes or collegiate athletes who want to be professional, my approach to everything I learn and see is along the lines of, does this increase performance? And can I get someone to a high performing state quicker? So when I went through school and was learning, you know, the baseline of, oh, they've had an ACL replacement, here's the protocol. Well, my question was never like, you know, how do I remember this? My question was always, was there a better way? Is there something else I can add in? And was always on the lookout for that. So it's why my approach is a little bit different. And I think just having that specific mentality with a goal in mind changes what we do. So for example, I have a certain machine at my Park City location that tracks the velocity and power of movements of a barbell, how quickly someone moves it left versus right, if they're shifting, all of these things. And there's only a handful in the United States. I have another machine that I can throw the barbell and the rack will catch it. And so I've talked to the two companies and we're combining them together, and I'll be the only one in the entire world with it. So now I can throw weight, have someone do a jump squat. They never have to catch the weight, but now I have the data behind all of it. So we're able to push out, you know, true peak power, peak velocity in a way that's never been done. And that's just by having an open mind of, can I increase performance for these athletes? Is there a safe way of doing it? And, you know, from an injury standpoint, if I can have someone lift to a point and then let go of a weight, I'm no longer worried about, you know, the compression and shear factors that happen when weightlifting. I can eliminate that.
Yeah.
And then we can combine another modality of blood flow restriction where they lift 30% of their body weight. So now we're doing less weight, more power. They don't have to catch it, and we get the data behind it. And it's constantly asking myself these questions of what I already know, what already exists, and combining these different fields together.
But I think that's an important thing that I've seen from evolutionaries like yourself, or they are constantly asking questions. The ego is not what drives life. It's the question and asking what is out there, what is better, what's the best way to do what it is that I want to do. So that's a great way to live your life. And you've obviously, at a very young age, achieved a certain amount of success in your profession and are leading out in a lot of ways. So congratulations and kudos to you for that. That's really impressive. Well, Skyler, on that note, it is time for us to wrap up another Evolve podcast. I want to thank you, our guest, Dr. Skyler Main, for being on with us today. And I want to thank my co-hosts, Mr. Las Vegas Leaflet, Casey Mitchell, and Chef to the Amish, Miles Riley.
Chef to the Amish.
We've had a great conversation today, and we hope that you, our listeners, took something with you that are going to help you in your personal evolution. Skyler, I know we barely scratched the surface with what's on the tip of your brain. You go so much deeper. So if people want to learn more, they'd like to get some coaching, some treatments, rehab from you, what's the best way for people to contact you?
Yeah, so either through my social media platform. So Instagram's at doc.main, M-A-Y-N-E. I get reached out to a lot on Twitter. So if people want to ask questions and are remote and can't get in, same thing, at doctor.drmayne_. And then, you know, my kind of trademark, what I do with people is I give them access to my number whenever they need it. So I'm more than welcome to text or call. My work cell, it's 801-916-4446. So.
All right. Let's give that number once again.
801-916-4446.
4446. And you're on Instagram, you're on Twitter, very active at answering questions. You are, I would describe you as extremely magnanimous. You do not charge people for your opinion. You're certainly worth a lot in what you deliver. But if somebody just wants an opinion, you're always welcome to give it. So we appreciate you joining us. We'd love to have you back another time to go deeper on some of these topics. And want our listeners to connect with you as well. And Casey, how do people find us at the Evolve Podcast and join the Evolve community?
Yeah, please join us at Evolve_cast on Instagram. Our website is evolve-cast.com. Please leave us comments and questions. Anything you heard today or the other episodes. We want everyone to be a part of our community. We all learn from each other, and everyone always has a great story to tell.
And we really don't own the Evolve community. You, our listeners, own it. We love to have people connecting with each other and having those conversations. We don't have to be a part of it, but we'd love to start those conversations in your personal lives. Miles, you showed up to the day without a shirt on. How do people not end up like
buy
you
a shirt
and get an Evolve or a Disrupt shirt?
Go to the website. We've dropped some new gear. There's new shirts. There's the Evolve water bottle. So we've got, we've got new gear at the shop, and all you have to do is go to the website and give us a look. Also, our Facebook presence has increased. So join us on Facebook where we are, again, actively talking about our personal evolutions, whether they are grand in scale or small in stature. An evolution is an evolution. And join us on Facebook and come hang out with us. And again, you know, join the community and tell us how you think.
All right. Thanks. And once again, thanks to Dr. Skyler Main for joining us. And thank you, our listeners, for listening to another episode of the Evolve Podcast, a podcast that explores personal evolution through our choices and overcoming the challenges that life throws at us. And now it's time for you to get out there and evolve.
And evolve.
Thanks for listening. Join us next week for Evolve 12, where we talk to Hall of Famer, the OG Jazz Bear, John Absey. That's next week on the Evolve Podcast.